Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on bluechipspeakersnaba.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker tonight. And we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. Robert is going to be telling his story tonight. And he was one of the first guys that I really noticed here at the NABA Club. He just had a way of putting things. I mean, really got the feeling that Robert lived what he was talking about. You know, it's been about 6 or 7 years now, and if anybody's going to come up here and tell the truth, I'm going to put it on this guy right here. So y'all, please give Robert a big, warm round of applause here.
My name's Robert Bell. I'm an alcoholic. And Tim, that was really nice. He's really held me to a high standard here, and for an alcoholic to tell the truth, my gosh. But they ask us to do that here. And as I look around and I look at all the people who are here, there's a lot of people I know. There's a lot of people I know from NABA, and I've got a lot of friends that come here. And I know many of them well, and some maybe not as well as others. Then I look around, there's a lot of people from my home group, too. And I know them a lot better. You know, the home group is really important. Tim mentioned the fifth tradition group is my home group. We meet Saturday nights, have a speaker meeting like this. It's a great place to come if you don't have another place to go. We have a big book study on Thursday night. It's a closed big book study at 8 p.m. We also have a beginner's meeting at 7 p.m. on Thursday. And we take meetings to places like treatment centers, like Peachford, on Tuesday and Wednesday night at 8 o'clock. We go to the DeKalb County Jail and take meetings there, and I do all that stuff. And I love that kind of service. And if you haven't got a home group, you need to get one. Because you know what happens if you're in AA and you don't have a home group? You're homeless in AA. And that's no place to be, man, because I can tell you about that, and you'll hear about that a bit in my story. But then I also look around. There's guys I see here that I sponsor and guys that I meet with on a regular basis. And I know them better than any of the others. Maybe most important, my wife is here. Know her the best of all. I'm really glad she can be here. Carrie has faced some challenges recently. She had to have an operation on her leg. She's had the cast removed recently. She was under physical therapy. And you know, that's the kind of thing that is just challenging. But, you know, when you live sort of an AA way of life, you have things happen, like the home group coming and helping out. And that was one of the miracles that happened with AA, and that's what's happened in my life before as well, and I'll mention that. Before I get going, though, let me ask a question. How many people are here in their first 6 months of sobriety? If you can raise your hand in their first 6 months. Look at that. That's wonderful. Welcome to AA. We're glad you're here. Let me ask another question. See who's willing to answer this one. Anyone here in their last 6 months of AA? And I ask that, and I've got a good reason to say that, is my sobriety date is April 10th, 2001. And that's when I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I say I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous because that's what's happened. That wasn't my first time here. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous 10 years before that. And I came in under the threat of going to prison. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was in and out and in and out. And every time I was in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was in my first 6 months of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't know it, but I was also in my last 6 months. At the very same time. And why does this happen? You know, I come in here and people are standing up here and they're telling the truth. They come here and they tell the truth. I believe that's what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. People get sober, have the capacity to tell the truth about their lives, because I know they wouldn't get here and tell the stories they're telling if it wasn't the truth. Nobody would say that stuff. And, you know, I'm wondering what they're talking about. They're talking about being here and they're not drinking on purpose. And I don't understand that, man, because I come here, and when I'm here and I'm not drinking, things are just a little off. They're a little edgy. And I'm coming here, and I'm hearing people talking about the things they do. They talk about a home group. I did not get involved in a home group. They talk about things like sponsorship. They talk about the big book, and I see this big book. People are carrying around. There's people who are identified as big book Noxies, big book thumpers. And I'm thinking, I don't know about that. In fact, people talk about them sort of funny, and I'm shying away from that. I'm the kind of guy that I show up right when the meeting starts. I'm on time. I'm punctual. Show up at 8 o'clock. See, I didn't realize there's a meeting before the meeting. There was a lot of people here before the meeting. They were out visiting with their friends. And I was punctual when I left, too. You know, the Lord's Prayer, zoom, I'm out of here. I am not doing the things that sober people and Alcoholics Anonymous are doing. I'm not taking advantage of the literature. I'm not taking your steps. And consequently, I'm in and out, in and out, in and out. I cannot come to Alcoholics Anonymous and just not drink and be comfortable. I just can't do that. And consequently, I'm in and out over and over and over. and I can't figure this out. I sort of consider myself a fae. I can't figure out what's going on, but somehow I'm staying out of trouble with the law. I'm staying out of jail. But then that day comes. That day comes in April. And it comes in April 10th, 2001, when I show up at Alcoholics Anonymous. And what is it that's so markedly different from that day, 12 years, that I've been able to stay sober and relatively happy this whole time, whereas the 10 years prior to that, I'm in and out, in and out, in and out. I can boil it down to really just one word and one word only, and I think it may be the most important thing that changed my life dramatically. That one word is sponsorship. Having a sponsor who understood the nature of his problems, you know, he could identify with me the way that he drank. He had a working knowledge of the 12 steps. He was armed with the facts about himself. You know, it wasn't too long before we started doing things. He'd bring me to meetings and he'd started going through the book, but he pointed out something that I thought was really important. He took me to page 44. And he said, you know, Robert, the book says if when you drink, you have little control of the amount that you drink, which is that phenomenon of craving, or if when you want to quit, you cannot quit entirely, and that's talking about the obsession, says you're probably alcoholic. He says, if that be the case, then you're probably suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. A spiritual experience. I had not had one of those spiritual experiences. I'd been coming to your meetings. I was a meeting maker, but I can tell you I did not have a spiritual experience as a result of these meetings. And an illness. How is my drinking an illness? I could not understand that. I mean, I just like to go out and get drunk. Every day. Couple blackouts a week, you know, that kind of thing. How is that an illness? I didn't understand that. And I thought about the illnesses I'd had, the kind of illnesses I'd had. You know, you go to the doctor and they give you a pill. So what I need is I need one of them spirituality pills. Give me a spirituality pill. No, give me two or three. I know what kind of guy I am. Or give you a handful. It'll last me the whole week. Or the other kind of illness I've had. I've had illnesses like where you have to go to the hospital. I had an appendicitis in my mid-20s. You check in the hospital, they cut it out, you're done, you're through. You don't have to hang around with the people suffering from their appendix. You do not have to have a sponsor. You don't have to go to meetings. You're done. You're through. That's the kind of illness I wanted. Who wants a kind of illness like we have here? The book describes it as a spiritual malady. Who wants an illness where you have to turn your will and your life over to the care of God? Who wants an illness where you have to do moral inventories over and over? Who wants a kind of illness where you have to make amends to virtually everybody you know? Who wants a kind of illness where you pray and you meditate? Who wants a kind of illness where you carry the message of recovery to the sick and suffering alcoholic as a way of staying sober yourself? Not me. That is not the kind of illness I want, but those are the cards I got. How did I get in that position? Well, I can tell you, when I was 15 years old, I was hanging out in front of the high school gym with my buddy Rex. Now, I'd grown up in a home where, you know, we had good family values. Sort of that traditional stuff. My parents had stayed married, had good educational opportunities. I had good religious training. Let me tell you, religious training and a spiritual experience are not necessarily the same thing. But I was taught right from wrong. However, all that stuff didn't necessarily click. I'd been told about the evils of drinking and drug use and all that kind of stuff. You know, Bill talks about that in his story. And I heard those very same kind of things. And yet I was sitting there with my buddy Rex, and this friend of ours pulled up as a Volkswagen van. We immediately knew it was the McClellan brothers. These guys lived up in Roswell. I went to school to sort of an area around Chestain Park. And these guys pulled up, and I knew it was going to be Jim and John, and it was a senior and a junior, and we were 15 years old, and they slid that door open, and they said, we're getting ready to go out and do some drinking. They had a couple cases of beer, and they said to me and Rex, do you want to join us? And we said, you bet. We jumped in there. And let me tell you what was going on with me when I was 15. As adolescent, I was a little insecure. I was probably no more insecure than the average 15-year-old. But, you know, I did okay in school, wasn't quite so good in sports, didn't know how to talk to women, not too good with the guys either, just couldn't relate. And all this was going on inside of me. But if you were looking at me, you might say he fits in pretty normally. But what was going on in my head, I was a mess. They invite us, and these are the kind of guys, too. These are the kind of guys, they played in a band. I wanted to be in a band. Everybody loves the people in a band. I like that idea. These guys talk about going out with women. I like the idea of going out with women. They talk about having sex with women. You know, I mean, I'd had sex. I'd always been alone. But these were the kind of guys I wanted to hang out with. So I can remember we jumped in that van, and my thought was, you know, I can remember my parents drinking, and they'd have a couple drinks. There'd be laughter. There'd be parties at our house, and people would be having a good time. And I wanted to see what this drinking thing was about. I wanted to have a couple beers. And my thought was, I'm going to jump in that van. We're going to have a couple beers, and you know, see what's going on. But what happened that night was the very thing that makes me alcoholic. I'm thinking I'm going to have a couple beers. I jump in that van and I end up having 6, 7, or 8 beers. I don't know that I got sick. There was certainly no trouble with the law. Nobody went to jail. Nobody went to the hospital. None of that kind of stuff. But one of the things that makes me alcoholic is I lost control of the amount that I drank. Now, the other thing that makes me alcoholic happened, too, because it wasn't too long after that. I was out trying to figure out from our older brothers and things like that, where are we going to get more beer? You know, the thing that makes me alcoholic happened that very first time. I don't know if I was an alcoholic by the definition we study here, but I enjoyed drinking, and I wanted to do it again. You know, I enjoyed that sense of ease and comfort, like the book tells us. Well, you know, it wasn't too long after that, I ended up hanging out with a guy, and we were driving around, and it was a May evening. It was probably 1971. I was 16 or 17 then, I guess I was 17, but we were driving around the Chattahoochee River, and there used to be this big race that went around the Chattahoochee River a long time ago. It's called the Big Raft Race, and a couple hundred thousand people would go down the river. And I can remember we were driving across the river, and this buddy of mine, Drew, I was sitting in his trunk, he says, get in the glove compartment. I reached in there, and I pulled out this bag, and in it there was some reefer, and there were some reefers already rolled up. And he said, do you want to smoke one of these? Well, you know, the first time I was exposed to that, I'd said I was never going to do that kind of stuff, and he lights it up and passes over to me, and you bet I hit that thing the first time. And I don't know that I fell in love with smoking reefer, but I can tell you one thing, it seemed to enhance the effect that alcohol had. And that wasn't all bad. So, you know, I found out that I was doing that kind of stuff, and before I knew it, I was dating this girl, and this is the second or third girl I dated, and I was over at her house, and her parents were at the front of the house, and she invited me to the back of the house where her bedroom was, and I thought this was good. She closes the door and locks it, and I thought this is getting better. And she did this ritual I'd never seen before. She pulled out a mirror, she dumped some white powder on it, had a razor blade, chopped it all up, and divvied it up into lines, and pulled out a spoon and a straw. And she looked at me, and she batted her eyes a few times, said, if you'll snort this with me, I'll let you feel my boobs. Well, you can imagine what happened. I ended up drinking and doing drugs for the next 25 years. And, you know, I really do believe in singleness of purpose, but I also have to tell my story. And if I knew that drug use would be so problematic in AA and that AA would be so cachet when you come around to the 21st century, I probably would have stayed away from some of those drugs. And oftentimes people get up here and they start apologizing for their drug use. And, you know, there were times when I had to apologize to my parents and my brother for my drug use because it, you know, it created shame and disappointment in them. So I'd have to apologize to them. And I certainly had to apologize at times to school administrators and teachers. They caught me as I was practicing the things I'd learned about economics, about buying large, breaking it down smaller, redistributing. And that caused problems and apologies. And, of course, there were those apologies to police officers and judges and things like that. When I'm sitting in a room of Alcoholics Anonymous, a little intermittent drug use between my drunken binges seems hardly appropriate for me to need to apologize. But the most of my story will have to do with alcohol. There will be some things that happen because it sort of is the way that it impacts the way that I live my life. And so, you know, my drinking continued through high school and, you know, I made it through college. In fact, I zipped through this 4-year program in 60 months. Just no problem. Zoom right on through. And the reason I could do that is because I was pretty good at taking tests. You know, I could take oral tests. I was really good because I had a lot of sort of BS about me. I could do the written tests okay. I could do the long handwritten test. And then when I got out of school, however, I found out there was one test I could not pass. That was a field sobriety test. And what happened is over a short period of time, a few years after I got out of college, I ended up getting 3 DUIs in just a very short period of time. 6 or 7 weeks. Had to engage the services of an attorney. I was making good money, and so that was an appropriate thing to do. And the thing the attorney told me, he says, Robert, whatever happens, say nothing unless I tell you to. And so I remember we're sitting in front of the judge, and he was flipping through these yellow tickets, you know, driving under the influence, DUI, DUI. And he had this big old tractor-fed printout, like the old-fashioned kind, and there's these other arrests that I'd had, all of them alcohol-related. This guy looks up at me, and he says, Mr. Bell, do you think you have a problem with alcohol? And I thought, no, it's all those Quaaludes I was eating. It's the problem I had. But, you know, he had a point. They had objective evidence that I was driving impaired, and they were right, and that was a good question. You know, if he had said, you know, maybe you should try AA, I would have paid no attention, I'm sure. But, you know, that would have been the follow-up question. But the fix was in. I'd worked it out with my attorney, and I think they all split up some money. Everybody got money but me. I know that's probably what happened. And so I avoided the consequences that would naturally occur. And out of college, you know, things were going on in my life. Friends were getting married. I thought maybe I should get married. And I was married before Carrie. And I met this woman, and we fell in love, and we got married. And, you know, if you're a guy like me and you drink like me, when you get married, it is the end of your troubles. It's the front end of your troubles. And the reason is my wife did not mind drinking necessarily, but she did not like drunkenness. And what happened with me is things would happen. Of course, there's those Friday nights. I'm going out and I'm meeting a guy like Pierce, and we're just going to go out and get faced. You know, we're going to drink. That stuff happens. And, of course, that causes problems. But there are these other times where you think you're just going to go, and it's about this time of night, and you stop, you're going to have a couple beers, you've worked a little bit late, and you're just going to watch a couple innings of the Braves game and then go on home. And what happens, I couldn't have explained it then, what happens is that whole craving thing kicks in. Next thing you know, the Braves game is over. It's 10:30, 11 o'clock at night. You've missed dinner. People are upset at home, and people are having a good time at the bar. It makes sense to stay, you know? Who goes home then? So you say that, and that's the way that, you know, when we say that we're hurting no one but ourselves, I didn't realize how many people I was hurting with my drinking. You know, as life went on, I could tell you a lot of other stories, but there's a lot of events that happened in life as well. We wanted to have children, and we were trying to have children. We couldn't have children. My wife went to the doctor to find out what was wrong with her. Obviously, it was her problem, but the doctor pointed out, no, your husband needs to be checked out too. So they sent me to my doctor and sent me for some tests. And they said, you know, there's one thing we can do. There's this abdominal operation we can do. It's a vein ligation, and it'll possibly help you and your wife have children. I wanted to be a father. I wanted to be a good husband. I wanted to do the things that I was being asked to do. So I went and I had that surgery. And, you know, when they make a cut in your abdomen, it is rather painful. And I noted when I came to in the hospital, there was a great deal of pain. And I complained of this. And the doctor said, you need not worry about that because there's an appropriate treatment for this level of pain. And it's called narcotic medication. And I said, all right, I'll try it. And so here's what I am. They gave me some of those pills, and that helped with that pain. But I also found that if I took a handful of those pills, that I could actually find a sense of ease and comfort that I found that was somewhat similar to the way that I drank. And I'd never really done this before, but I'd noted that I was running into problems at home with my wife. Now, if you're a newcomer, this is my plan. And there was a bunch of people here in their first 6 months. And so we know that you have plans, too. What you need to do is tell us your plans. Because your plans help us stay sober. A plan like the one I'm going to tell you might keep the long-timers sober for a bit longer. But here was my plan. My plan was I would take these pain pills when I wasn't traveling, when I was on the road traveling, and there was no, you know, supervision by the wife or oversight by the wife, that I could just drink the way that I wanted to. And that's sort of a good plan. But the thing is, the doctor wasn't giving me enough pills. So I had to go to my personal physician and tell him about this pain I was experiencing. And doctors care about their patients not experiencing pain. So my doctor gave me some more, and it still wasn't enough. So I ended up seeing a few more doctors and making more doctor-type friends, and they were all helping me out. And so this plan became an effective plan. So I could drink on the road, and I could take these pills when I'm at home, and it was a good plan. However, here's where the plan falls apart. I noted on the bottle it says, do not take with alcohol. And I thought this might mean that alcohol will enhance the effect of these pills. And sure enough, it does. So here's what I do. I do the kind of thing where I'd be on the way home and I was going to take these pills. And rather than just take it with water, I would end up maybe taking it with a couple beers and go on home. And I didn't realize it, but another 30 minutes or 45 minutes goes by, and all of a sudden that feeling that I was getting from alcohol, it started driving that need for more alcohol. I started to get thirsty for more alcohol. And so I'd walk into the pantry and see, do we have enough bread? Or maybe the refrigerator, we're getting low on milk. Because I needed to go out and drink. And so what would happen was I ended up going out and drinking. And so this whole plan I had just did not work at all. And so I ended up drinking, and I was popping pills. This kind of thing happened over and over. But you know, doctors are really quite compassionate with their patients, and they are considerate of their well-being, and they don't want them to like get addicted to these pills, and they start cutting you off. And so that's what happened to me, is they started cutting me off. And however, I had noted this one doctor friend, he left extra prescription pads in the back of his office, and I thought they might come in handy one day. And sure enough, they did. And so I picked several of them up one day, and I was carrying them around with me, and there came that time when I was just running out, and I decided, you know, I could fill out one of these things. I had saved one of the prescriptions. I mean, I'd turned it in. I made a copy of it and saved that. And, you know, the first time you do something like that, it's called forgery. There's anxiety. You know, you're scared of getting caught. There's a bit of worry. You go after the doctor's office. You make all these plans to avoid getting caught. But it's like after you rob stores or any of the ways you break the law. After you do it a while, you sort of don't even worry about it anymore. You just fill them out left and right, giving them to your friends, you know. You know, I wasn't a doctor and I wasn't a pharmacist, but I wrote those prescriptions, man, and I wrote them and enjoyed it. And, you know, this worked out well for a while, but there's also this other problem that can come along. And the problem is if you break the law frequently enough and do the same thing over and over, sooner or later you get caught. And that's what happened with me. I got caught, and I could have gotten away on a first offender status, and I'm not going to go too deep into all the stuff that happened, but I just couldn't stop. And before it was all over with, I ended up getting charged not only with forgery, I got charged with assault and battery, and I got charged with robbing a drugstore. And, you know, they just sort of seemed to find more things I was doing wrong, and I was doing all those things. You know, I sort of thought it was a conspiracy against me. But I was doing all those things. And, you know, I'd like to say that I went and hired an attorney, and the attorney said, what you need to do is you need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what happened. What would be a really good story would be to say, then I came in here and I got a sponsor and I got sober. But that's not what happened, man. I wanted to come to Alcoholics Anonymous and stay out of prison. And that's what happened. I followed the directions of my attorney like he was a sponsor. And I came and got sheets signed. I did all that kind of stuff. But I found out that you could still drink and get away with a lot of things. And, you know, my drinking continued to escalate. I was able to avoid prison, though, and that's a wonderful thing. I was on probation, intensive probation for a year, long-term probation for 10 years. And, you know, I'm going to sort of move on up towards the end because my story continues after I get sober. But it moves right on up to April 10th. And it gets up to April 10th, and I'm then on spring break. And in this interim, too, of this 10 years while I was on probation, this is an important part of the story, is my wife and I were able to adopt a son, Stuart. And I can tell you, it was really a breaking point in our life, too. This was 1987. It was several years after this problem had arisen. But I can remember we had applied for adoption. We'd gotten through all the paperwork that you have to. And we got a call a couple days before Stuart was born and said, we believe there's going to be a baby boy. Do you want to come and get him? And I can remember my former wife, Teresa, and I, we looked at one another and we said, you bet. As we drove down to Thomasville, Georgia, down at the southwest corner of the state, man, I was willing to commit to not drinking the way that I used to. I was going to change my ways. This was the time I had come up with that idea. And you know what happens is we go down there and we pick up that child and that little baby boy, Stuart, I mean, he is crying, and they brought him out in this laundry basket with towels on the bottom. I mean, I can still envision that. They brought him out and he was just a beautiful baby boy, and we put him in the car seat and we drove him back to Atlanta. And we got back to Atlanta and, you know, my parents came over, my in-laws were there, and the baby was crying and I was a little bit restless and irritable. And, you know, just like it says in chapter 3, suddenly the thought crossed my mind. And I wasn't putting scotch in with milk, but I was certainly having beer and drinking before I knew it. And, you know, that would have been one of those times. There's all those times in an alcoholic's life where I say, I'm going to quit. Now's the time. I'm done. I'm through. It's it. I'm not going to do it. And I swear I'm not going to do it. And circumstances change. Something happens to take me back to that first drink every time. It's happened every time in my life, except for one. And so that happened. That would have been a great time to quit, but that wasn't the time. So that little boy's growing up, and, you know, I am taking these pills, and I get caught, I get arrested, and I find out that even when you're on probation, you can still drink. And what happened is I made friends with the probation officer. I'll never forget, one time I go see the probation officer. This is after I was off intensive probation. But I go see the probation officer, and he's wearing a Peachtree Road Race T-shirt. So I go back and look through my drawers. I'd run the Peachtree Road Race floor. Next time I go see him, I put on the Peachtree Road Race T-shirt, you know. I want him to bond with me. And he did, you know. I got him to do stuff like sign a one-year travel pass. I didn't even have to go see him. So I found that I could still drink. And, you know, if I'd gotten caught, I'd be off to jail for 10 years. That would have been what it would have been if I'd violated probation. So I was fortunate. I got off probation. It's coming around to April. It's 2001. We're on spring break. We go down to Tampa. Stuart and I are down there with my wife, and we're spending some time at the beach doing all the things you do on spring break. We've been down there about a week. My wife had to come back and go to work on a Wednesday. So I'm thinking, well, I'll come on back. I'll go to work the next day. But that night, I get into town. I had been hanging out with my friends, and I knew they usually met at this place called the Buckhead Saloon, and we went over there, and we were doing some drinking, and I stayed out late, and I was going to work the next day. I'd call my boss, and I'm coming back to town. Is it okay if I come to work and save the vacation days? He says, you bet. So I get really drunk, and I come into work, and I'm not feeling good, and I found other ways to sort of get my hands on some of these pills. I come into work and I take a handful of them because I wasn't feeling good, and I just took a handful. So I'm moving around work, and all of a sudden, this feeling, I'd had this feeling before. It's that one where all of a sudden your mind is sort of shutting down and things are getting dark, and I know I'm about to just keel over, and I do, and I just fall down flat on the floor, and I'm sort of out in the main area. And I didn't mention this. At this point, I was working as a recreation minister for a church, and they particularly frown on drinking and drug use, but I remember I fell over and I was sort of shaking and having that seizure-like activity. But I hear in the back of my mind, is Robert okay? Call 911. And they haul you up and take you off to the Piedmont. That's where I went, actually. This wasn't the first time. But, you know, I can remember I came to. And you come to and you're sort of looking up at lights and there's people working on you. And every time that's happened to me, I'm thinking, was this really worth it? You know, was it a good time? I don't know. But you come to and they're telling you to breathe and all this kind of stuff, and they take you off and they're treating you. And when you get to the hospital, there's this whole problem you got. When you're there, like, they didn't tow your car along. They don't just, like, discharge you into your car. You have to call someone. And I call my former wife, Teresa, and this is what she said to me. I told her what had happened because she had known about all this stuff. I'd been arrested for, you know, drinking, for drugs, all sorts of stuff. She says, Robert, is there any hope? Is there any hope? And I'll tell you what, when people are asking you that question, that's about time to get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't know that was what was going to happen, but she asked me, is there any hope? Well, she comes to the hospital, and I can remember I'm sitting there with the doctor, and he's going through these discharge papers, and he says, the nurse tells me that you just were hung over and you took a handful of pills. You didn't even count them. Weren't you afraid of overdosing? And I said, no, doc, I was really afraid of that dreaded underdose, you know? And that's the way I drank, and that's the way I did drugs. You know, I was worried a lot more about not taking enough than I was about taking too much, no matter what it was, drinking or whatever. And so the doctor just shook his head, and he said, get in the car and get out of here. And so I went home, and my wife was a really nice lady. When I got there, she had some bags packed. And they were my bags. And she had made plans. She had already found a place for me, so I was going off to this treatment center, but I had to go detox. And so I went to the local detox, and I went back to Peachford. It was not my first trip there. So I went in. I can tell you one of the miracles that happens at Peachford happened to me. People from Alcoholics Anonymous came and brought a meeting. There's all sorts of things that go on at treatment. How many people, by the way, have been in the mental institute? Raise your hand. A bunch. Let me ask this question. How many people have been to jail? It looks like the same group. But not exactly. But you know, there's something about the mental institute, I like it a lot better, I can tell you. You know, there's choices of food, they start you off on drugs, there's women there. I mean, there's a bunch of things that's going on at the treatment center that's a lot better. But I can remember and there's things that they offer that are really good, maybe not for alcoholics. They've got recreation therapy, they've got all sorts of therapy, music therapy. But none of that stuff did any good for my alcoholism. But people from Alcoholics Anonymous came and brought a meeting. And I can remember they came and brought a meeting and they read off the title page. Now, I was a bit resistant to what they were talking about. They read off the title page, how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. And they talked about many thousands, that it's broad-based, men and women, that it's inclusive, have recovered. And so they said they put recovered there on purpose. They didn't say recovering. They aren't convalescing in AA. You know, when you have a cast on your leg, you're recovering. When you're out running again, you're recovered. He said they had recovered. They had regained their spiritual, mental, and physical health. Then they talked about alcoholism. They said it's a disease, and it's a disease that you can recover from. And they were emphatic about it. I was a bit argumentative. You know how it is. I had newcomer thinking, and I had things to think about. But I can remember they brought that in. And, you know, I can remember I also went, and it's pretty soon before discharge, I went and saw this therapist. And this therapist brings me into his office, and he asked me some questions. He says, Robert, have you ever been to Alcoholics Anonymous? And I said, sure. Everybody here has been to Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, everyone in the mental institute, they've been to Alcoholics Anonymous. They bring meetings in. He said, well, did you take the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous? And I said, no. And I think everyone in this room tonight, in their heart of hearts, knows that they've taken the 12 steps. They know if they've gotten on their knees and done that third step prayer. They know if they've done a written inventory at the direction of their sponsor. They know that if they're carrying this message to other people, that if they're being of service to others, I think in your heart of heart, you know if you've taken it. I said, no, because I knew I hadn't. And he thought for a minute, and he said, well, did you have a sponsor? I said, well, he said, that means no. He said, did you read the big book? And I said, well, I've got the big book. You know, it's got we agnostics and all sorts, you know. And he says, well, let me ask you this. He said, what did Bill finally do when he got better? I could not answer the question. I had not studied the big book for sure. He said, what Bill did is he went back to his hospital. He tried to carry the message of hope that he had found. And then he asked me this question. He says, do you think Alcoholics Anonymous can work for you? And I started to give him an answer. He says, oh, it's a theoretical question. Go back to the day room. You know, he just asked me that. And I think this is a member of Alcoholics Anonymous is asking real pertinent questions. He recognized alcoholism, sent me back to the day room, and I hung around there for a while. I ended up going to this place called Penfield, and they kept me for 6 weeks. And then I ended up at this charm school in the north part of Atlanta called Mar. And they sent me through feeling school, which was a real blessing. And but they did the miracle there. They also recognized that 12-step recovery was the great answer for alcoholics. And they sent me to AA. And when I got sent to AA, I went to this place called Peachtree Corners. Peachtree Corners had a meeting on Monday. They had a meeting on Friday. And they required us to get a sponsor. And I can remember I went there and I met this guy. And on Monday night, he had led the big book study. So Friday night, I knew the big book was important. I started looking for him. He is walking around. He is carrying these two books just like this, like he often does. And I asked this guy, Pat, will you be my sponsor? And he sort of thought for a second. And he asked me the questions most sponsors ask. He says, do you think you're alcoholic? He says, do you think you can stop on your own? And the most important question he asked, he says, are you willing to do whatever it takes to gain victory over alcohol? And I wanted to impress my sponsor. I said yes to all three. You know, I was a people pleaser then. You know, I was not willing to accept the truth. And he says, you know, Robert, you're the kind of guy that you'll say anything to please people. He was clear with me. He says, I really don't care what you think, and I don't care what you believe. He says, I care what you do. He says, I may say some things that hurt your feelings, and I may step on your toes, but I'd rather step on your toes than walk on your grave. And he was clear in what he wanted me to do. He said, we're going to start meeting every Monday and every Friday. I said, great, I'll see you at 8. He says, no. He says, I'll see you at 7. And so we got there, and at that meeting, it's one of those meetings where you have to set up chairs, you have to put up the steps, you have to put literature out, and you have to make coffee and do things like that. So we'd help set up the meeting, and then we'd sit down and study the big book until 20 till, and then he'd take me back upstairs where everybody was coming in. He said, we're going to go up and shake hands with newcomers. And so I was hanging around. The people I was hanging around with were the sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous and the people who wanted to get sober. Then we'd go up and shake hands with newcomers. I sort of followed them around, did what he did. And I've learned today is the people that hang out with the sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous and do what they do, they end up getting sober. And that's what happened to me. You know, we studied the book, went through the doctor's opinion. I found out about that stuff. I found out once I drink, I can't stop drinking. Can't control the amount that I take. I drink till I get drunk, and I just keep on drinking. You know, I'm the kind of guy that I watch through the Super Bowl, and most people are drunk and go home, but I'm the guy that goes downtown. You know, I want to keep on drinking. There's something else going on. Got to find it. When he started talking about his drinking like that, I could match up my drinking. If you can match up your drinking like that, you may be one of us. But then the greater dilemma, he had heard my story, and you've only heard little pieces of it. He heard my story. Why, after these arrests, do you start drinking again? Why, after going to detox, do you drink again? Why, after a fight with your wife, do you drink again? Why, after you lose a job, do you drink again? I did not have an answer to that. And he told me that I had this obsession of the mind. He told me the main problem, in fact, centers in my mind. I couldn't believe it. He said it's bad enough having this physical thing, but having a mental problem, I mean, that was just almost unbearable. You know, we moved on through the book. We got to page 63 and did that third step prayer, and he gave me directions for four step, did a multi-column inventory. In the process of doing that and my fifth step, I was able to look at my life in a way I'd never looked at it before. And really what I found out is the stuff that happened to me and the stuff that happens in my life essentially is all my fault. It's either all my fault or the way that I responded to it is my fault. And you know, if that's not what you believe after a fourth and fifth step, you might should do another one. I really think that. That was the truth that I found out, is the stuff was my fault, the way that I responded. I'm selfish, I'm self-centered, and I step on the toes of others, and they retaliate. And that's the story of my life. You know, he took me on to step 6 and 7. We started asking God for help with character defects. He had made a list for me when I did that fifth step. He gave it to me, and there's plenty of amends to make, and he said there'll be plenty of others, but this is a good start. So I started doing all that stuff, and he kept pushing me right through the book. As soon as I'd made some amends, we went ahead and did step 10, said we've got to continue on this spiritual way of life. And we got step 11, did that, and I couldn't believe we got to page 88. And he says, Robert, it's time for you to start sponsoring people. I said, Pat, I'm only 4 months sober. He said, that's okay. He said, Bill was only a couple days sober when he was talking to other people in the hospital. He said, Dr. Bob, his sobriety date was June 10th. June 27th, he is out seeing Bill Dodson, 17 days sober. He says, you're fine. And I said, well, what'll I tell him? He says, you don't need to worry about that. Nobody's asked you to sponsor him. Cross that bridge when you get there. He said, but get on your knees and ask God for someone to help. And I started doing that. Sure enough, believe it or not, sooner or later, some poor fool asked me to sponsor him. And I said, Pat, what do I do? He said, tell him to do the same stuff we do. Ask him the same questions. Give him some stuff to read. Talk to him about that stuff. Go through the book. He says, go through the book and share your experience. Don't tell him what you think. That'll mess him up. Tell him what you've done. Tell him your experience. So we did that. And, you know, during that time, I moved back home. I was back with my wife and son. My dad had been living with me for a number of years, and he was older. He was 82. And it was actually in August, just this time of year, 12 years ago. I was new in sobriety. It was, you know, from April 10th to about now. And my dad had been sick. He had gotten an infection. He had a pacemaker. Got an infection there. And he was in the hospital. It didn't look like he was going to make it. And it was a Saturday morning. And I can remember I went to see him. It was early before the nurses and everybody had gotten in there. And he looked at me and he says, you know, Robert, there comes a time in every man's life where he has to make peace with his God and his fellow man. And I've done that. And I'm ready to meet my maker. And that sounds like something you'd hear in Alcoholics Anonymous. But, you know, this was just a man who had a grip on the way to live life. He knew that he had to be at peace with God and his fellow man. And he was ready to meet his maker. Now, I wasn't ready for him to go, but he was ready. And I remember that conversation just like it was yesterday. You know, 2 days later, he died. It was a Tuesday. And I was standing around him with my wife, with my son, with my brother and his wife. And we said prayers and we read things that he would enjoy hearing read that would give him peace and give him comfort as he breathed his last. And, you know, he died on a Tuesday and the funeral was on a Friday. And that Friday, I was able to do a part of the funeral. You know, I'd known some of his business associates, certainly knew his brothers and sisters and the nieces and nephews and a variety of others. And I was able to do that. And my son came up and he actually read the 23rd Psalm. And what I would have never expected is that within 1 year, we'd be reading the 23rd Psalm at my son's funeral. And what happened is Stuart completed the suicide act. He hung himself. He was 15, and I would have never believed this would happen. And when things like this happen, let me make just a couple comments, I'll get back. When things like this happen, people say, where is God? Why do bad things happen to good people? Where is God when children die, when children get cancer, when all this kind of stuff happens? And I'll tell you what I think happened. I think God did not abandon me. In fact, I think God was right there with me, and He is crying right alongside of me. I believe that with all of my heart. You know, that morning I'd gotten up and I'd asked God to help me stay sober. And I had called my sponsor. I'd called some guys back that had called me. I was getting ready to go to work. My wife came in from running and she says, Robert, go down and get Stuart up. He was supposed to go to soccer camp. And I went downstairs and I came around the second flight into the basement where he lived. There was a closet ahead and there's a rope hanging down and his feet were on the ground and his knees were nearly on the ground. And I really thought he was going to stand up like he was playing a trick. But he didn't. And I walked over and held him. You know, there was no first aid that could be done. There was no CPR that would make a bit of difference. And I ran up the stairs, and some of this my wife reported to me. I screamed, and she jumped out of the shower and said, Robert, what's happened? I said, Stuart's hung himself. And I asked her to call the police. And I went over and picked up the phone, and I called my sponsor, Pat. I'd been calling him every day. I'd already called him earlier. He didn't expect another phone call, but he got one. And he says, oh, my God, Robert, I'll be right over. And sure enough, he came over. And, you know, Charles Dickens writes that it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. And you can understand how this was the worst of the times. When a tragedy like this occurs, when you have something that's so stigmatized like suicide, it's hard to imagine. But let me tell you why today, from a different vantage point, it was the best of times. Pat comes, and I look out the window, and all of a sudden I see my friend Matt E. pulling up, then Art S. driving up in his motorcycle, and then people from my home group pull up, people from Peachtree Corners, and the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous happened. During that time, I can remember I sat down with Pat and a family friend, and Pat says, Robert, grab your big book and give it to Joe. Joe was a family friend. He said, open to page 63. We did the third step prayer. God, I offer myself to Thee, to build with me and do with me as Thou will. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do Thy will. Take away my difficulties, so that victory over them may bear witness to those I might help. Thy power, Thy love, Thy way of life. Yeah, do thy will always. And I believe that prayer was honored. Relieve me of the bondage of self. Take away my difficulties. Well, those difficulties didn't just go away magically. It took some work. But I stayed sober that day. And I stayed sober based on the fellowship. I stayed sober based on the fact that I'd taken the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I stayed sober based on the fact that I was relying on God. I had found a sponsor that was God-reliant, God-conscious, God-driven, God-focused. And he had taught me the very same thing. He said, my job as a sponsor, it's great to have a sponsor. My job as a sponsor is to take your hand and put it in the hand of God so that you can rely on God. I was relying on God that day. I could have gone and drank, or I could have called him, and I called him, and that was the gateway to staying sober. People showed up, and people helped us out a lot. It's the kind of tragedy you can't imagine. You know, I can remember 3 days later, in the midst of this tragedy, one of the guys I'm sponsoring a handful of guys by then, this one guy calls up, and I won't mention his name, we'll call him Bob. Bob calls up, and he's drunk. And I'm saying, and I'm on one of these old-fashioned flip phones, Bob. And he's drinking. And I said, Bob, I can't believe it. I've got other things to deal with here. Why don't you get up tomorrow and go to NAB and pick up a white chip? And I just hang up on him. That's all I need to know at that point. And Pat, my sponsor, stands there, and he's a little taller than me. I remember looking up at him, and he looks at me. He says, Robert, you're the luckiest guy in the world. I said, Pat, what are you talking about? He said, if anyone should be drinking, it's you. You've got a sponsee drinking for you. And he was right, you know. So in the midst of this, there was a little laughter here and there, but it was a tragic a proportion. You really can't imagine. But by that Friday, we buried Stuart, did the 23rd Psalm. That was during the day, and I'll remember the church was full of people from Alcoholics Anonymous, plus other people. I'd grown up here in Atlanta, so I had a lot of friends, old high school buddies and stuff like that. But that night, I went back to my home group. I went back to Peachtree Corners at the end of July. They're having their birthday meeting. I can remember Pat was actually doing one of the readings, and I can just remember looking up at him. Our eyes sort of meet. And it's that kind of look that you get every now and then in Alcoholics Anonymous, where people look at you, and you sort of get this feeling like, I think it's going to be okay. That's back at the very first meeting. It's a couple days afterwards. I think it's going to be okay. Well, it took a while for it to get okay, certainly. I ended up, as I drive around, here's what will go on me the next little bit as I drive around. I'd be driving up Buford Highway, and I might look over and see some church where there's a soccer field out back, and I'd say, well, if Stuart was alive, he'd be playing soccer. And I'd drive someplace else, I'd say, well, if Stuart was alive, we'd be getting ice cream at the Dairy Queen. If Stuart was alive, you might would say, as I was going along through my life, I was obsessed with things. My mind couldn't get off of it. I was sort of powerless over what was going on in my life, but with my mind. And my life was as unmanageable as ever, but there was a new degree of unmanageability thrown in. And as you apply the second step, maybe I could come to believe that the power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. And the insane thing would be that I'd be forever captured and, you know, just bound by that one event for the rest of my life. And I had to believe that maybe God could help with this too. And I started praying about it. I had to make a decision. I'm going to do something about this. And people have pointed out that there are people that have to deal with suicide. There's sort of aftercare for suicide, suicide support groups. And it's peer-led. It's not like a counselor telling you what to do. But people have been through that same experience, and they share what they're doing to get better. And I found one of those, and I started going. I've been going for a while, and actually, I found that it actually helped. Hearing people learn to actually talk about death by suicide. I didn't know that I could ever mention the words. There seemed to be a lot of shame and guilt and all sorts of things. But I found that I could get better by taking action, some of it by direction of the sponsor, some by him saying, go ask people that know about it. And I did that. And actually, I got well enough where they said, Robert, you're actually doing pretty good. Maybe you could facilitate these groups and help other people who are suffering through the problems due to suicide. And I did not want to commit to anything else, but I asked my sponsor. He said, you would be good at it. You need to do it. If they ask you to do it, do it. And so I did it. I went through a little training, and I do that, and I still do that. About once a month, I'll lead a group. And if suicide occurs and people won't help, now you just don't go out and see people if it happens. But if people won't help, I'm willing to go out and see them. There's sort of a team of us to do that kind of thing. And, you know, I can remember there's this one woman who sort of started this kind of stuff, and her son had died about 30 years ago, and I was following her at a meeting we're having, and I said, Iris, why is it that some people in this group, and I'm talking about this survivors of suicide group, I said, why is it that some people in this group seem to get better and some don't? And she looked at me and said, you know what, Robert? People seem to get just about as well as they want to. And she turned around and walked right on. And she's right in that group, but it happens in Alcoholics Anonymous too. And I found that you get better in Alcoholics Anonymous by getting a sponsor. A sponsor is a good thing. It saved my life in 2001, again, when I faced those challenges. My sponsor directed me to do a lot of things. It's been very, very helpful. You know, life continues when those kind of things happen and challenges occurred. My wife and I faced challenges. You know, she had lived with me as an active alcoholic for a number of years, 17 or 18, and, you know, then the death of a son. That's the kind of thing that can just sort of be the dividing line, and we end up getting divorced. And those kind of challenges occur in Alcoholics Anonymous, but you don't have to drink over those things. And out of bad things, sometimes, you know, people talk about beginning and endings, but sometimes you should look at life as endings and beginnings. So as one thing ended, there was an opportunity for a new beginning, and I met Carrie, and we ended up getting married. And so that's been a real blessing. You know, I've been able to stay employed since I got sober. I have had different jobs. In fact, one time they came in, they let everybody go. And I was hired by the people that took over the contract like the next day. And I learned this kind of stuff in Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I learned is there's some key things. How many people in here are looking for jobs right now? There's a lot of people. Here's one of the things I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I learned it from my sponsor. He says, what you need to do is you need to go to work, you need to stay at work, and most importantly, you need to work at work. He said, you probably have never done that. He said, work is not where you check Facebook. You know. And so those little tips, these sponsors have practical life tips to help you stay sober, to help you get a job, to help you keep a job. And so there's been a lot of things that have happened that have been really great. You know, I enjoy my home group. We started about 4 years ago, and there's probably 15 of us that were at the first meeting on a Thursday and had a business meeting, and it's grown to where it's rather large. And I've had the opportunity to hold service positions there. I've had an opportunity to take meetings to jail. And it's a real blessing when you go to jail and you see these people and you know that if one out of 30 shows up, it'll be a miracle. We've seen some that have showed up and stayed sober, and they come here and they go to other meetings, and I've seen the Atlanta Roundup, and some that actually got up and did performance at the Roundup is absolute miracle. And you see things like that in Alcoholics Anonymous that I never believed I've seen. Alcoholics Anonymous has transformed my life. I love everything about Alcoholics Anonymous. I love having a sponsor. I love being a sponsor. I love having a home group. I love going to other groups. I love finding new guys. I love sitting on the front row. I always sit on the front row. My sponsor told me early on, and, you know, alcoholism is a disease of perception. I got a couple more minutes, and I'm going to close off. He said alcoholism is a disease of perception. And the reason I know this is when I was new, you know, he was getting me to help set things up. He's helping me do all sorts of things. And he says, Robert, you know, you've told me this story. You've been in and out and in and out and in and out. He said, now here's what I heard. He says, you've been in and out, in and out, in and out. What I want you to do is sit on the front row. The front row is for dummies. It's for dummies that go in and out, in and out, in and out. Dummies like you need to sit on the front row. No offense. Upon reflection, see, my sponsor does not talk like that at all. What he probably said is, Robert, we can pay better attention if we sit on the front row. Because he'd come sit on the front row with me. He'd say, you know, when you sit on the front row, you don't pay attention to who's coming and going and who's getting coffee and things like that. Sponsorship is something that has been a real blessing for me. And that is one thing that if you have not done in Alcoholics Anonymous, you need to work with your sponsor till you're ready to do that. You know, I even get the grapevine. They've got the grapevine back there. And I love the grapevine. If you're new, you're saying, what is the grapevine? Well, the grapevine is AA's meeting in print. If you're new, you're thinking, the last thing I want is some alcoholic sending me a magazine to my house. However, they take precautions for that, and what they do is they send it out. When it comes in a black wrapper just like this. And the people are laughing. Why do you think they're laughing? Because they know what usually comes in black wrappers. Yeah, you're right. Porn. Eric knows. So one day, it's that time of the month where it's supposed to come in. I run out the mailbox, and it's there, and I run in, and I'm just smiling, and my eyes are sort of gleaming. And Carrie says, you know what the neighbors think, don't you? They think you're out there bringing the porn in, you know? So I love everything about Alcoholics Anonymous. It is time for me to close. There's other stories I could tell. There's great things that happen in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I'm going to close with one thing out of the 12 and 12. And a man that was very active here, Bob M., died a couple years back of cancer. When I was new, he led a beginner meeting at Peachtree Corners, and he'd say, when you're new, buy the big book and buy the 12 and 12, read it and reread it, and I still do. And this is out of the 12 and 12, step 12, and I'll close with this. Furthermore, how should we come to terms with seeing failure or success? Can we not accept and adjust either without despair or pride? Can we accept poverty, sickness, loneliness, and bereavement with courage and serenity? Can we steadfastly content ourselves with the humbler, yet sometimes more durable satisfactions when the brighter, more glimmering achievements are denied us? The A answer to these questions about living is yes, all of these things are possible. We know this because we see monotony, pain, and even calamity turned to good use by those who keep on trying to practice AA's 12 steps. And if these are facts of life for many alcoholics who have recovered in AA, they can become the facts of life for many more. I truly believe that if you come to Alcoholics Anonymous, take the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, that nothing happens in your life has anything to do with taking that first drink. And the question I've got for anybody that's new tonight, do you think Alcoholics Anonymous can work for you? God bless. Thank you very much.
Tell it, brother. Thank you, Robert. That's service.
First I slept, and then I crept to a hope-filled dream. You rescued me, and finally, waking there I see. Look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promises are real. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, stride for stride, we walk eternally. Look into love's window for a heart for me. Takes me where the promises are real. And I always long for something to set me free. Take me where the promises are.